Great. So welcome to the next session of the 23rd Annual Credit Suisse Communications Conference. I'm Doug Mitchelson, Credit Suisse analyst covering media and cable, satellite, and telecom sectors. For those mapping to a little vote going on this month for the sell side, vote early, vote often. Remember, it's a team effort here at Credit Suisse, and particularly, I'd like to acknowledge the excellent conference team and who worked tirelessly to put all this together. Thrilled to have with us today Bob Chapek, CEO of Walt Disney Company, 28 years now with Walt Disney, and another Big Ten alum. Format's fireside chat. I have enough questions to run the full session. Bob, thank you so much for spending some time with us today, and we'll jump right in.
Thanks, Doug.
So look, you stepped into the CEO role right in the teeth of the pandemic, have had a busy, busy first 16 months, NFL deal, Star launch, much more. You're able to put your initial stamp on the company, though, with the segment realignment. So there's a lot to talk about. Let's start from a high level. As we emerge from the pandemic, what's Disney's strategy to create value for its various stakeholders, and what does the management team have to get right to deliver that value?
So I would start by saying that despite the challenges of the last 18 months or so, we're as optimistic as ever about the future of our business. As you had referenced, we instituted a reorganization to support our more aggressive push into direct-to-consumer, and most importantly, that guaranteed strong, steady content flows into all of our channels of distribution, based on our strong brands and our incredible franchises. That's really our biggest competitive advantage. At the same time, I think our more mature channels of distribution are ensuring those strong cash flows, so we want to keep those things healthy so that we can continue to make the kind of investments that are necessary to achieve our goals in direct-to-consumer. And then we want to distribute those pieces of content in ways that really embrace both the changing consumer behavior that we're seeing and obviously the, you know, more short-term but very important recovery from COVID, and do that with a certain flexibility and balance between both, you know, short-term operating performance and long-term shareholder return. In terms of our other big piece of our business, our parks and experiences business, aggressive push into direct-to-consumer, and most importantly, that guaranteed strong, steady content flows into all of our channels of distribution, based on our strong brands and our incredible franchises. That's really our biggest competitive advantage. At the same time, I think our more mature channels of distribution are ensuring those strong cash flows, so we want to keep those things healthy so that we can continue to make the kind of investments that are necessary to achieve our goals in direct-to-consumer. And then we want to distribute those pieces of content in ways that really embrace both the changing consumer behavior that we're seeing and obviously the, you know, more short-term but very important recovery from COVID, and do that with a certain flexibility and balance between both, you know, short-term operating performance and long-term shareholder return. In terms of our other big piece of our business, our parks and experiences business, we've really used the shutdown in order to fully reconsider, I'd say, every aspect of our operation, to not only improve our guest experience, but at the same time, manage our yield and accelerate the work that we've been doing in that yield management area for about the last five, six, seven years. And we're happy so far because we've seen some really encouraging underlying demand as we dig out of COVID. And we've got the, I think, with the ultimate test and the ultimate situation for yield optimization experience, so that we can commercialize that demand, but also at the same time, improve that guest experience without having to necessarily, you know, put more people in the park in order to grow our business. So, at the same time, though, I think we've really continued to invest in our intellectual property despite COVID in our parks, given that strong historical ROIC that, you know, we've had, in our parks investments and the plethora of storytelling opportunities that we have across our business.
So before we delve into all that, I did want to ask sort of one more big picture question, which is whether Disney has got the right mix of assets. And I think about, do all these assets have a purpose being together? Do you have the right amount of scale in each of them, regardless of what happens around the company in terms of consolidation or deconsolidation, as the case may be?
Yeah, we're really happy with our portfolio of assets and then the ecosystem that commercializes those assets. Storytelling, as you know, Doug, is at the heart of everything that we do. And again, we have that enviable group of brands and franchises that I think is really the envy of the entire industry. So let's witness the last couple of weeks, because an example may be the best way to sort of to talk about this. First, we opened up Avengers Campus at Disneyland Resort, and that's gone spectacularly well. And then we've premiered Loki on Disney Plus. And, you know, both of those obviously being part of the Marvel ecosystem. And I think that just shows how across different businesses, across times and across geography, we can use the strength of our franchises across these distribution assets and really make the best out of it. And then we have the opportunity to do that on a global scale more than ever, not only because of the legacy distribution channels that we have, but also because of the newer direct-to-consumer distribution channels that we have across the globe. So we really think that right now we've got sort of, you know, at least in terms of today's environment, we've got the right balance, the right scale, as you say, to really take those brands and franchises, which again is the framework underneath what supports everything at the Walt Disney Company. That's our foundation. And so we're very happy with our asset mix.
Right. That makes sense. So ever since he started the brand council at Disney in the late 90s, Bob Iger talked about his desire to get closer to the consumer. That's something you've had at the parks in your time there, but the rest of the company is essentially a wholesaler until streaming launched. And so my question is, you've developed more direct relationships with more and more consumers around the world. Is that going to meaningfully influence strategy or revenue? And when would we start to see any impact at the Walt Disney Company?
Well, as you said, our parks business has long had the longstanding direct relationship with our guests. And with our direct-to-consumer business, now we have the opportunity not only to grow that audience, but the frequency of engagement and look at the touch points that we've got in order to drive, let's call it, new connections between those previously separated businesses. And you have to keep in mind that when Disney Plus really launched and started to get traction, we had to shut down our parks business. So this is really the first time we've ever been able to operate in parallel, both our parks business and our direct-to-consumer business, which is giving us the opportunity really to cross-market and those two businesses across lines of businesses. So we think that we've not even begun to scratch the surface, if you will, of that cross collateralization of market data and mining that in a way that's going to benefit our business and our shareholders.
You know, talked about the parks and where you have those direct consumer touch points. Next generation might not grow up watching the Disney Channel, might be verboten to say, but you know, it's hard to get their eyes unglued from their screens, and they've got more viewing options than ever. How do you capture the attention and the imagination of the next generation, keep the magic of the Disney brand going? I was thinking sort of relative to the allure of the parks, but perhaps this broadens out to all of the company's products and services.
Well, keep in mind, given our new reorganization, the creatives that might make what we would have considered our great Disney Channel content in the past are now making our, you know, young family content across the entire ecosystem. So whether or not that content may appear first on Disney Channel or may appear first on Disney Plus, we still got the same talented people that are in that space that know how to speak to that audience, that have had the tremendous legacy of success making content for that audience through Disney Channel, now are making it regardless of distribution channel for our Disney Plus platform. So, you know, we always look at our businesses through two lenses, both obviously the media side and the experience side, and we get to leverage then all that great content that's been made through both of those avenues, leveraging the common brand and the common franchise affinity that we're able to do that. And because of the four quadrant appeal of our content, it then gives us benefits on Disney Plus, which is a four quadrant outlet, even more. It gives us more advantages than going to something like a Disney Channel, which would be, you know, maybe a little bit more limited in terms of its overall appeal. So, you know, we think that whether it's new content or library content, it really gives us the ability to take that ecosystem that we have, take the skill that we have in terms of those great creative people and apply it in a more broad, more general sense to appeal to a wider audience.
That makes sense. And so let's keep going on the park side of that, you know, where you personally led $20 billion of capital investments before becoming CEO. It would seem there's a lot coming up. You have 50th anniversary of Walt Disney World, new cruise ships, developing Shanghai, which is still sort of relatively young, 5 years old, building out every park globally. You know, would you have to update us on the experiences that are, you know, sort of coming up the next 5 years, especially ones that might add to revenue capacity?
Sure, sure. We've got ambitious plans to expand our business. I had just mentioned, you know, Avengers Campus a second ago, and we're encouraged by the great response we have there, but we're not stopping there because, as you know, we've been undergoing a massive transformation of our Epcot Park at Walt Disney World in Orlando. And we've got a Ratatouille attraction that we're bringing in that first premiered in France. We've got a new nighttime show, Harmonious, that'll be on the water there at Epcot. It's going to be a huge guest pleaser. And then we've got our Guardians of the Galaxy Cosmic Rewind attraction, our coaster, that will give us our ability to bring that whole Marvel franchise into the park. Internationally, we're thrilled to bring Zootopia into Shanghai Disney Resort. You mentioned Shanghai. That's obviously a property that did extraordinarily well in the box office when Zootopia came out, so that'll be a big hit in Shanghai. We've got Frozen installations coming into Hong Kong, Disneyland. At Disneyland Paris, we've got the twofer of its own Avengers Campus taking off from where Anaheim has. The recent launch of Avengers Campus. And we've also got the Art of Marvel Hotel that we're putting in, we're installing. Tokyo Disney Resort, we've got the 8 themed port over at Tokyo Disney Seas. We've got 2 new hotels and attractions going in for Frozen, Tangled, and Peter Pan. And then we've got 3 new ships and a second island destination. So we certainly have a plethora of new things coming, and that's really mining all the work that we had done prior to the pandemic and kept working on during the pandemic so that we would not have any sort of glitch in our supply chain of new attractions and experiences for our guests, so we can keep that growth engine of parks going.
Yeah, and now you've always been sort of excited about the outlook for parks, and you talked a little bit earlier about honing out those yield management skills during the pandemic. You talked previously about structural changes, operating costs. We also mentioned that earlier. So if we add it all up, increased capacity, smarter pricing, lower, you know, cost structure, certainly seems like parks could deliver margins looking out a few years well above its prior peak. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think we're optimistic about our margin story going forward. We expect our admissions per cap to continue to benefit from our, let's call it, data-based pricing models that we've moved to over the last couple of years and strategically managing our attendance across different ticket types. As you know, Doug, that there's significantly different outcomes depending on what type of ticket package a guest historically has come into our parks with. And by managing that as a percentage of the whole, we have a significant opportunity to obviously improve our outcomes. And this pandemic is giving us the opportunity to completely reconsider how we do that. On the cost side, you know, we've done things like dramatically, you know, in the interest of sort of contactless guest experience during the COVID time, it dramatically improved our mobile ordering opportunities in the park, contactless check-in at our hotels, virtual queues. We're really using those so that it sort of releases the guest more to do things inside the park and enjoy the park, have a better experience, but also have an opportunity to experience more things. And that obviously has a revenue impact for us. And then just to manage the guest flow and the overall experience so you can have the same number of people or more people in the park, but at the same time, give them a better experience. And these are all things that, frankly, without the stoppage of COVID, we never would have had a chance to completely reset like we've done. So I think the margins have a chance to have an impactful, if you will, recovery. But long term, we're going to realize some margin benefits from sort of being able to implement all these given the COVID shutdown.
All right, so still with the parks, but lastly, are consumers coming back and how does the demand look overall?
Yeah, our forward-looking reservations are really strong at our domestic parks, and we're seeing also strong underlying demand at our Disney Cruise Line in terms of what we're seeing from consumers. And that's, by the way, despite the pause, the uncertainty about the cruise industry, and the frankly limited marketing that we've done so far. And as you know, we're going to be releasing a new ship next year called the Disney Wish, and we're seeing strong response to the inaugural season of that. So we're very encouraged by what we're seeing across those businesses. As you know, the COVID restrictions get released and the case counts go down and governments release their constraints on us, whether they're local or federal CDC type guidelines. And we want to open up responsibly, and we want to do so in a way that's going to maintain that guest experience.
So let's shift over to content, not to date myself or perhaps you for that matter. But we first met back in sort of 2008, a while ago, when your focus was on home entertainment and driving the DVD marketplace. And one thing that really sort of sticks with me to this day beyond your energy was just how in tune with you were with the content being created and how aggressively you were reshaping how that content was being distributed. And so what are the big changes of your first year as CEO? We mentioned it earlier, resegmenting the company to separate content creation from distribution. So any bumps in the road implementing that new structure and all the new reporting lines on the content side of the house? And what's the experience been so far?
You know, despite how profound that change was for us, relative to how we operate and particularly how the industry operated, it's really gotten very strong buy-in by our execs. Obviously, a lot of socialization and collaboration went into that before we did that. But I think everyone appreciates the clarity and accountability and the fact that as we now double down on our content investment going forward, as we announced in our December investor conference, everyone appreciates the fact that they've got more time to do what they do best, given this increase in output that we have. We're ramping up in scale in this new content, and it really enables, on the other end, on the distribution end, for let's call it an objective assessment for what's right for distribution for our company from an enterprise level, given those changing consumer preferences over time. I've always said that the ultimate acid test for this reorganization would be our first five-year plan. Because remember, everything we've done up until now has really been a plan that was set years ago, right, before this new organization was contemplated. So we were essentially living with an old plan, operating it under a new organizational model. But now with the new five-year plan, we actually get a chance to plan from this point going forward with this new conceit and with this new structure. And I must tell you, I've been extraordinarily pleased with how well it's gone and how well everything's worked. So I think that bodes well for the future in terms of the impact of this new organizational structure on our goals to dramatically accelerate our DTC business.
Good. And I think it's 2008, but I meant 1998. I probably should have stuck with 2008. Can you maintain quality while increasing the pace of content manufacturing? What's your level of confidence in the upcoming slate? You had a record-setting run pre-pandemic.
Yeah, well, we certainly have a strong legacy in the past of great content driving really great business results. But I have to say that I'm encouraged going forward as well. We've always said that we're going to focus on quality over quantity and maintain that high batting average that Disney is known for, extraordinarily high batting average, in fact. I think what we're seeing is that the increase in demand is really empowering our creatives to think outside the box from maybe a more limited slate and try new different things like we've done, for example, like WandaVision or Loki, really taking a different approach that if you were more constrained to only say three or four projects a year, you might not want to give it a shot. And I think that's actually been empowering and liberating for our creatives. So it's actually worked quite well. Our creative teams are all focused on their franchise now. For example, in the past, the Marvel teams, which arguably are the best and most qualified to create Marvel content, made Marvel movies, but they didn't do Marvel television. Well, now Kevin Feige and his team are not only making Marvel movies, but they're making all the episodic Marvel content as well. And this is part of what happened in this recent reorganization, which I think makes all the sense in the world. So, and you know, with the expansion of streaming now, you know, people like Kevin get to branch out, not only in terms of the degrees of freedom that they've gotten their storytelling to do things that are different, but also different mediums, different timeframes, you know, 2 hour movies, 2.5 hour movies, but also, you know, episodic series that last roughly an hour. So it really is liberating for the creatives. And I think we're seeing the dividends from that.
Now, I'm not sure if this is a question or a statement, but I have an important Marvel fan asking me if you would please bring Iron Man back.
Well, tell your Marvel fan that we've got a series called Armor Wars coming up, starring Don Cheadle as War Machine. And I think that will probably scratch the itch that our fans have for more Iron Man.
How much more IP is there to mine on the Marvel side? I think, recall when Disney acquired Marvel, skeptics thought, you know, Spider-Man and the Hulk and a lot of the good stuff had been licensed. Obviously, you created massive new franchises in Guardians and Black Panther, and you got Shang-Chi and Eternals coming. You got a new series coming to Disney+. What are your creative teams the most excited about?
Well, I've always learned not to underestimate our creative teams, particularly our Marvel creative teams. You know, we've got 8,000 characters that we have to mine. And you say, well, 8,000 characters, who knows what these 8,000 characters are? But remember that all of our Avengers, for example, our Avengers characters, when we made the acquisition, weren't exactly household names. You know, take Loki, for example. Loki was the most watched season premiere ever on Disney Plus during its opening week. And no one knew who Loki was. Even when we got started on this journey on Marvel, no one knew who Iron Man was, or, you know, Wanda or Vision or Falcon, you know, or the Winter Soldiers, Black Widow, Shang-Chi. Nobody knew who these characters were. They certainly know them now. And I think that speaks to the fact that, you know, our creatives really can take something in this universe, in this mythology, and really bring it to life through interconnected tissue and interconnected storytelling. And so, you know, not only are these series great, but we've got three feature films in the next 6 months. So I think proof is being demonstrated that as you increase output and you go deeper and deeper into mining the Marvel mythology, that it doesn't have to sort of tap itself out, because as we've been able to demonstrate, we've got great stories to tell, and we're telling great stories. And by the way, now with the Fox acquisition, we have things like Fantastic Four to add into that. So I see it's pretty much an endless opportunity for us.
So let's shift over to the distribution part of that content story. And historically, you put content out through theaters, retailers like Walmart and pay TV companies. Disney's always enjoyed leverage associated with having the importance of the company's content. Now there's connected TV platforms like Roku and Amazon and Apple and Flex forming. They want to help you get customers, which is great. How would you contrast this sort of shift in distribution with, you know, how it was before? Any concerns that they might become gatekeepers in the future and start to eat away at content economics over time? And sort of throwing it all in there, what's your vision for content distribution when you look out 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, I think the vision is really getting closer and closer to the consumers. You made a reference to, you know, how we started this whole process off when we started our direct-to-consumer initiative earlier. It's really about having a granular understanding of what the consumption patterns are, and then speaking to the consumers in a way that's going to be relevant to the content that they want specifically for themselves. And by doing so, we'll drive engagement and consumption. in terms of actually the relationship that we have with our distribution partners, the key is having a win-win, having a strong symbiotic relationship. And that's what we've got, as they really want Disney content and we bring that value to their platform. So as long as we have a symbiotic relationship where we bring something they need, we get something that we need. It's a healthy relationship. And with the wide variety of content that we have in our machine, I think we'll continue to have that very positive, very productive, very symbiotic relationship.
So let's turn over to the pricing side of that content distribution. So consumers have historically paid a premium for Disney's offering. That happens at the parks, that happens at cruises, happens at home video. Disney Plus was arguably, you know, very, very attractive, you know, level to spark initial demand, particularly in the United States, and the service's subscriber success has been impressive as a result. So how much value do you feel you're delivering at this point in time to consumers with this service? What's the path to right-sizing pricing over time to capture that value? And just to give the U.S. Example, where you had a recent price increase of about a dollar, does a dollar a year get you there in a reasonable enough time frame relative to the value you're delivering?
Yeah, in terms of, I guess, an objective way to look at the price-value relationship, the growth rate that we've experienced on Disney Plus sort of stands out as the headline there. But you're right, we did launch at a very attractive price-value opening point. And, you know, the first price point or first price increase that you mentioned in first 16 months happened recently, and we see no significantly higher churn as a result of that. And in Europe, as a matter of fact, we took a price increase twice as high as we took domestically, more or less. And that was with commensurate with the integration of the Star brand as a six brand tile, but our churn actually improved, right? So we took an even higher price increase and our churn improved because we added more content. And I think that investment in the content at attractive price point gets you strong retention. And strong retention obviously is one of the key factors towards overall platform growth. And but that doesn't mean that in the future, as we continue to add more and more great content, that we wouldn't necessarily reflect that in the value that we add and then price it accordingly. So we think there's some room there as well.
Do you see the potential for Disney Plus to evolve into a platform the company can sort of leverage beyond its current, you know, call it offering of video streaming? So, you know, for example, do you envision including consumer products, connections to your parks, gaming, et cetera? What does Disney Plus look like to the consumer in 5 or 10 years?
Well, you know, our franchise machine is really important to us, and we're always evolving it and, you know, employing our franchises in the best way possible to benefit our business across line of business, across geography, and across time. And we believe, as I mentioned earlier, that our direct-to-consumer business will now enable sort of new connections, if you will. So what we want to do is start to marry our databases and mine those things. And frankly, we're very ambitious about our thoughts about how we can do that in ways that we've not yet been able to do it, whether it's because of COVID or because we just got through our launch. I mean, we're just now getting to the point. Keep in mind, we're still sort of in the launch phase across the world of Disney Plus, and some of the more refined ways of thinking about this so that we can manage this as an ongoing concern and do what we do best, which is to operate our businesses. You know, that we've had, you know, a great launch, but it's been under far less than ideal circumstances. Well, those more normalized circumstances are coming, and we're going to get to do what we do best, which is to operate our business in a way that, you know, benefits the consumer and our shareholders. And we're just getting started.
Well, you know, and I've got, as you might imagine, a couple more follow-ups on that. Again, notwithstanding that you still have part of the world left to launch, I'm still sort of curious about the long-term strategy here. And I think from the video streaming standpoint, do you envision Disney Plus having an advertising supported entry tier, you know, around the world? Certainly audiences around the world are used to seeing the Disney Channel with advertisements, which is different than what you have in the United States.
Yeah, you know, we're always reevaluating how we go to market across the world, but we've got no such plans now to do that. We're happy with the models that we've got. But again, we won't limit ourselves and say no to anything, but right now we have no such plans for that.
And the other part of that is I wanted to ask about taking the brand tiles that you have in the service to more of an a la carte format, because I think Disney is relatively unique in terms of the number of standout brands that you could even do something like that. So, for example, Marvel, Star Wars, National Geographic, instead of as part of just you get all of this with the Disney Plus service, have you thought about sort of selling each of those on an a la carte basis? And the rationale would be you could expand consumer choice, you could broaden out the subscriber base and allow Disney to price and sort of resource its product based on the value of each brand, each genre, sort of more specifically in that format. And if not, do you still see this as sort of, continue to offer in the United States, Disney Plus, ESPN Plus, Hulu on a standalone basis? Do you think it'll be all one offering at some point in time like a Netflix is today?
Yeah, I think our more aggregated model right now is serving us well. And I also believe it's serving our guests well. It gives us a very nice price value, which we just talked about being so key to our Excel ourself. And it also gives us efficiencies versus having to, market, let's say if we have five brand tiles, five different offerings at the same time, that would get pretty expensive from a marketing standpoint. But again, it also has some benefits with our customers in terms of being able to give them a wide offering, because there is sort of a large overlap between people that like Marvel versus people that like Star Wars and people that like Disney. Now, the caveat there is that we already have some different models, as you know, across different markets across the world, given, customers' preferences, our own assets that we've gotten, different viewing situations and habits that our customers have. So again, we won't say no to anything in the future, but right now we're really happy with our more highly aggregated model that we have, both from a cost standpoint and from a market opportunity standpoint. But again, who knows, it could evolve over time as we learn more and more in different regions across the world.
All right, understood. So, one question we're increasingly getting from investors is how much each company needs to invest in content to compete in streaming, and particularly with Netflix as the leader. You've talked about how important content is to driving new subscribers. At the same time, the strength of your brand should give you an advantage. What have you learned after 18 months in the marketplace?
Well, it all does start with the strength of our brands and those franchises. And those the promise of the content to come. I mean, we've got built-in benefit. Once you have a brand, you have a built-in machine, you have built-in momentum, because people like Wanda, they know they're gonna like, Falcon and the Winter Soldier. They like Falcon and the Winter Soldier, they're probably gonna like Loki and so on and so forth. And you build up a reputation. But if you really think about it, in addition to that, I think what we've done is reaffirmed our strategy, and our strategy is really based on, from a content standpoint, that we're going to work globally off those five core brands that really do have broad appeal. We're going to emphasize more than ever our general entertainment content, both in the Star Plus and Hulu formats. We're going to really focus in on some local content and really double down there in our international markets. And we've got the machine to do that now. And we're going to focus in on Hotstar, both from an entertainment standpoint and a sports standpoint, given its benefits in those regions. So I think what we've learned is that we're going to continue to do more of what we're doing.
And I got a few follow-ups sort of on this concept, because I think it's really intriguing. I mean, how much engagement do you need to earn the price you charge? And how do you decide, what the right amount of content is?
Right. Well, we spend a tremendous amount of time making sure that engagement is high. And that's really what our distribution team is charged with. And, part of that is about the value of any one piece of content. And if you can look at it two different ways, right? There's the incremental marginal benefit of a single piece of content and what that does to the service. But then there's really what it adds to the overall portfolio and incrementally to the overall service. So we really tailor our content in terms of the number of active hours that are needed to maintain healthy engagement. So you look at it individually, but you look at it holistically at the same time. And then we don't just do this though overall for the service. We do it overall for specific engagement groups and customer constituents within the service, so that you're building it by constituent, by type of content, both individually for that piece of content and overall for the overall service. And you try to work up, you know, sort of the best overall scenario, if you will.
One of the things I wanted to clarify is you've said on a couple of different occasions that you'll have new content on Disney Plus every week soon. Is that a new TV series or movie starting each week, or is that a new episode of a TV series or movie each week? And I'm curious because if you'll continue to do an episode at a time versus dropping entire series at once.
Yeah, our plan is to do hit that cadence this year, in terms of, you know, a new product every week. And what we mean by that is a new movie or series, meaning a new production or library ad every week. And that's not counting new episodes, if you will, but does count new seasons. So we count new seasons, we don't count new episodes in that. And something new can be a new movie or new piece of content or something new added to the library. So that's how we're defining that. And, you know, that's the plan right now. But just like everything we've talked about, we're going to evaluate and iterate that going forward. But we've got such a great opportunity to mine our content and create new things, and have had such success at it that our plan is to continue with that one per week defined by the way that we just did.
And you've emphasized Disney having a significant amount of relative, local content for a streaming service overseas. Can you offer more details on that aspect? Because you've sort of emphasized a couple times that you'd be strong there.
Yeah, you know, we spend a tremendous amount of time now with our regional production teams, which have been recently, if you will, internally grown through the help of our Fox acquisition. And they've been ramping up. They're focusing on general entertainment, obviously, that's relevant to the local region, but there's nothing to say that that content that's created, say, for Latin America or created for Europe or created for Asia can have legs and, you know, really travel sort of elsewhere. In some cases, it's looking at sports and the benefit of adding sports in some markets. And as you know, we've done that in places like Latin America. But make no mistake, our foundation is always going to be those global franchise oriented businesses that we've been able to make the foundation of our entire company, essentially.
Yeah, and you're sort of taking me right to my next question, which was, news and sports. Others are starting to focus on those genres for their streaming services overseas. Well, Disney need to invest more in content for streaming to sort of maintain share of engagement over the time, or the franchises and brands you're delivering, you know, enough to drive your services already? It's almost as if each, company is recreating their own mini pay TV bundle, and we're always struggling with how many can win in this marketplace.
Right. Well, we're going to look at those opportunities selectively. You know, you look at our Star Plus business, which, you know, we're locating or launching in Latin America on 831, and that's general entertainment and sports. So in that case, yes. You know, and then you look at how deep are we going. When we go into it, we're going big. For example, in Argentina, we're going to have 10,000 live sporting events per year in Argentina. So if we're going to do something, we're going to do it right. We're going to do it big. But it really is a market by market evaluation. And that's one of the ways that we're approaching this DTC business, is not to assume that every market's the same, or we're going to have one global approach. We're going to customize what we do by market. And if it gives us a slightly different way to go to market or look at what assets we need to get, then so be it. But we're going to do what's right for each market. And so it depends.
So continuing on sports, ESPN. So it's one of the areas I'd say of greatest uncertainty for those not investing in Disney. And, frankly, I understand that you have little incentive to discuss taking the main ESPN network to a la carte streaming until you've completed, at least the Comcast and Dish renewals and finish up a full cycle since the company started shifting direct to consumer. So I thought we'd try it this way. What would you say to those skeptics that ESPN, regarding the health of ESPN, call it sort of 5 years from now?
Well, we're committed to sports because we value live sports, which drives viewers and interest like nothing else. We all know what the statistics say about you know, who turns into what, and live sports always leads the way. So sports are important in terms of being able to bring in the viewers. We know ESPN's at the top of their game and the leader in live sports. And ESPN can do it across the linear methods of distribution, the digital methods of distribution, and the DTC platforms. And that linear also happens to have the benefit of providing a tremendous amount of cash flow, which is really funding the operation, not only in a post-COVID standpoint where we're trying to recover from that, but also given the extraordinary investment that we need to make in direct-to-consumer. So it's really providing a very strategic purpose for the organization right now. That said, that over time, if that were to change or our reliance on that business would become lessened, that we would reevaluate our options. We always say we're going to be in a business if it increases our shareholder value, and sports is no different. So we'll reevaluate that over time. But right now, it's operating very well for us and doing something that we, you know, really need, which is generating a lot of cash for us.
So I imagine, you're not going to want to put a time frame on as to when ESPN Network will shift to a la carte, though we'd certainly, you know, welcome that today if you wanted to. But is there visibility you can offer for investors on the front end, like a period of time where you know it's highly unlikely and wouldn't make sense? I mean, the math seems challenging the next few years when I think about it in terms of downside risk to linear revenue versus streaming upside. Is it fair to say that ESPN a la carte's unlikely the next 2 to 3 years?
Well, I'm not going to comment on specifically when we believe that timing is going to be, but I would point to the fact that we bought flexibility into every new media rights deal that we've done in terms of sports rights. And I think you recognize that. So the speed of the transition will be dependent on the speed of the evolution of the consumer behavior. Ultimately, we will be guided by our return to shareholders. And so we believe that's best served by keeping our eye on what the consumer wants. And when full content migration to such a platform makes sense, we'll be prepared to do that. We don't believe that time is right now, but when it is time, we'll be prepared to do that.
So looking across the linear networks in general, how did the upfront go, and what was the sales strategy, you know, volume versus price? We did have Jeff from NBC Universal earlier say the upfront's done for them. Fox said, well, almost done. You know, where's Disney at?
Well, this is our first year of consolidated sales across our entire enterprise into one ad sales group. And so for us, the results were really, really encouraging across our portfolio, I should say. We had price increases versus 19, which is, again, probably the best base year to evaluate it against, that were all significant. And our total upfront revenue was up by double digits. And I think, you know, that's sort of a nice headline, if you will. But 40% of our sales this year were actually in streaming and digital, which I said think speaks to the nature of how this business is rapidly changing. And obviously, we're well positioned to do that as the business continues to evolve. So we're really happy with the upfront. Our sales team did an extraordinary job.
So, you know, let's add it all up on sort of the network side of the house. You know, linear network business was an awfully good one for Disney the past few decades. Will the pivot to streaming allow Disney to sustain or grow its historical profitability in media, you know, making up for linear's inevitable decline? Or is that unrealistic given the costs that come from being a streaming retailer and how competitive that will be relative to competing within, you know, what was a pretty cozy pay TV bundle for a long time?
Yeah, well, we believe that, you know, we started this early enough while the, you know, sort of the legacy business is still strong enough that those lines, when added together, will continue to grow into the future and we'll have a strong growth engine in media going forward. Now, as I mentioned many times, that linear business does offer us an attractive cash flow and it funds that content generation across our ecosystem as we make that accelerated pivot to DTC and the, if you will, the hunger for new content that such a new platform sort of requires. But we've only just really begun that content rollout internationally. And I think, you know, as we grow, we develop and control those DTC relationships, capturing a higher percentage of the economics as well. You know, let's never forget about the difference in, you know, the keep rate on some of these different platforms. All platforms are not created equal, if you will. And so that gives us the opportunity to take one business, you know, and, you know, trade it for another that might actually, as we go direct to consumer, give us a higher capture rate, if you will. So we're just in the beginning of this journey, but we're really optimistic that the media business is going to be a growth engine for us for the not only the midterm, but the long term as well.
So, you know, interesting discussion today across, you know, all of your businesses. I wanted to leave with sort of a final question. You know, will the board restore the dividend and what will guide that decision, Bob?
Yeah, well, that is a board decision. As you know, they meet a couple times a year just to discuss this issue. And they'll take into account what they've taken into account in the past, which is, you know, what's our strategic investment outlook? You know, where are alternative uses of capital and what are those priorities? What's our financial leverage look like coming out of COVID? What's the operating environment look like in terms of the release of restrictions that we've got that might constrain our business going forward, or at least, you know, give us some time to actually ramp back up to full operating mode, if you will. What's really just the overall recovery of our businesses across the entire enterprise. Our first priority, though, I can pretty much guarantee you, will be funding our DTC growth. That's going to be our first priority. And then after that, you know, we'll look beyond that and see what our next priority is going to be in terms of that dividend. I should say that our dividends will be a part of our long-term capital allocation strategy for sure. But that's once we have a normalized operating environment. And I guess it's in the eye of the beholder as to what's a normalized operating environment, given that, you know, we're just now in the next week coming online with our final theme park reopening in Paris and our cruise line still not yet operating.
That's right. So with that, you nailed it on time. It's a great way to end. And Bob, look, thanks so much for the thoughts today. Thank you for all your time. Thank you for everyone listening in. And as we noted earlier, look forward to having these meetings in person rather than virtual. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Doug. Appreciate it.